Thank you, James. If you have a New Testament, please, would you open it to the 5th chapter of the Gospel of Matthew. As we continue with Jesus' explanation and reinterpretation of the Old Testament law, a law which the Pharisees had garbled and misinterpreted, in which Jesus will come and now tell us God's true intent for those commandments. Last week we looked at the topic of adultery and the transition from Jesus' words on adultery to His teaching on divorce is a very natural progression. Because in certain circumstances, Jesus will tell us that remarriage by or to a divorced person can be equal to adultery. And this third antithesis that we'll look at this morning is essentially a call to faithfulness in marriage. I approach this topic this morning with the same bit of reluctance that I did last week. First, because divorce is a controversial and complex subject. And even in the words we'll look at this morning, there are honest differences of opinion. But that's not my greatest hesitation. I feel comfortable with what this text means and how it applies. My greatest hesitation comes from knowing that this is a subject which touches people's emotions at a very deep level. There is almost no unhappiness as intense as the unhappiness of an unhappy marriage. And almost no tragedy so great as the degeneration of what God meant for love and fulfillment into a non-relationship of bitterness and discord and despair. And although I believe that God's way in most cases is not divorce, my desire this morning is to approach this subject with sensitivity. For I know the pain which many have suffered. And I have no desire this morning to add to your distress. And yet it is because I am convinced that Jesus' teaching on this subject and every other subject is good, intrinsically good, for individuals, good for society, that I take my courage and preach on. We pick up Jesus' words this morning in Matthew 5, Verse 31. And it was said, "Whoever sends his wife away, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except for the cause of unchastity, makes her commit adultery. And whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery." Now, these two verses can hardly be thought to represent the sum total of our Lord's teaching on divorce. They're an abbreviated summary of His teaching, which is why I had Don read for us the 19th chapter, which is a fuller explanation of Jesus' teaching on divorce. And we need to take those two passages together and interpret the shorter in light of the longer, which we'll do this morning. And what Jesus was facing in His time was that there were two conflicting views concerning divorce between the rival rabbinic schools of Hillel and Shammai. And the controversy centered on a phrase in Deuteronomy 24, which we're going to look at in a moment, which is the only passage in the Old Testament which talks about the grounds or procedures for divorce. Rabbi Shammai took the very strict view and taught that from Deuteronomy 24, the sole ground of divorce was some grave matrimonial offense. Something indecent. And Rabbi Hillel, on the other hand, held a very permissive view, which was the common view in Jesus' day, and interpreted the Mosaic provision to mean a man who desires to be divorced from his wife for any cause whatsoever. And so something unseemly or decent was interpreted in the widest possible way to include a wife's most trivial offenses. If she burned the bagels, it was grounds for divorce. In fact, Rabbi Akiba, who was of that school, went even so far to say that a man could divorce his wife if he found another woman who was more beautiful. Sounds very common. The Pharisees seem to have been attracted by Rabbi Hillel's view and stuck to it, which seems to explain the form of their question. Is it lawful to divorce a wife for any cause? In other words, they wanted to know on whose side Jesus was in this contemporary debate. Now, I want to summarize Jesus' words on this topic in three statements, because I think his answer falls into three areas, and I want to take them in order, consider them separately. In each case, he dissents from the Pharisees. The first statement I want to make is this. The Pharisees were absorbed with the grounds for divorce. Jesus with the institution of marriage. Their question was so framed to draw Jesus out on what he considered to be legitimate grounds for divorce. For what cause might a man divorce his wife? For one cause? For several causes? For any cause? Jesus' reply is not a reply. He doesn't answer their question. Instead, he asks a counter question about their own reading of Scripture. He refers them back to Genesis, both to the creation of mankind as male and female, and to the institution of marriage, by which a man leaves his parents and cleaves to his wife, and the two become one. And that biblical definition implies that marriage is both exclusive and permanent. And it is those two aspects of marriage that Jesus selects for emphasis in his comments that follow. First, he says, so they are no longer two, but one flesh. And secondly, what therefore God has joined together, man must not separate. Therefore, marriage, according to our Lord's exposition of its origins, is a divine institution by which God makes permanently one two people who decisively and publicly leave their parents in order to form a new unit in society, and then become one flesh. Marriage affords the deepest possible unity in earthly relationships. Deeper than with the children who come from our bodies. Now, I distinctly remember the moment each of my three sons was born. And I remember the bond that I felt when I held each of them in my arms. And I saw me. Now, and that bond has developed closer and closer all of these years. But, according to Jesus, although that incredible bond is there, I am not one flesh with any one of my children. I am only one flesh with my wife. And Jesus is very clear that God's ideal was and is a monogamous, intimate, enduring relationship. Second statement I want to make. The Pharisees called Moses' provision for divorce a command. Jesus calls it a concession to the hardness of human hearts. Now, the Pharisees had grossly misinterpreted this Old Testament passage. Because you will never find a statement along the lines of Jesus' citation here. Whoever sends his wife away, let him give her a certificate of divorce. You will never find that statement in the Old Testament. This is actually a rabbinic misinterpretation of the passage I mentioned to you in Deuteronomy 24. In fact, let me read you that passage. Deuteronomy 24, 1-4. You don't have to turn to it. You can listen if you want to. You can. But I'm not going to take time to wait for you to get there. When a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out from his house, and she leaves his house and goes and becomes another man's wife. And if the latter husband turns against her and writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, or if the latter husband dies who took her to be his wife, then her former husband who sent her away is not allowed to take her again to be his wife, since she's been defiled, for that's an abomination before the Lord, and you shall not bring the sin on the land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance. Now, if you read it carefully, you'll see that God is not saying to put your wife away if she displeases you. Knowing the heart of men, Jesus knows that there are some men who'd put their wife away for almost any cause. And the term here for some indecency is a very ambiguous term. No one knows precisely what Moses is referring to, but it really doesn't matter. Because he's not saying that there might be an occasion when your wife does something indecent and that's the cause for a husband to put her away. The whole paragraph hinges on a very long series of conditional clauses. And the thrust of the passage is to prohibit the remarriage of one's own divorced partner. This prohibition is the only command in the passage. There is certainly no command for a husband to divorce his wife, nor any encouragement to do so. He is saying, with the use of all those additional clauses, if a man puts his wife away for some cause, he can't have her back. And the purpose of this law is to protect women from exploitation. That's the point. Because men in those days treated women like junk. And if they burned the bagels, it was out. And he'd give them a bill of divorce, and it would satisfy the legal demands of the divorce, and the woman would go to another man, because women in those days seldom could exist as single people. There was no place in society for a single woman. And she'd be married to someone else, and he would discard her. And Jesus says, you can't have her back because you can't treat women that way. That's the point. They're not junk. You can't marry them and remarry them at your will. That's the point of the passage. You can't just throw them out of the house. That's your wife. And even if you do it legal-like and you give them a bill of divorce, you can't have her back because you can't treat a woman like that. And the Jews completely misunderstood the point of that law. And Jesus responds to the Pharisees' questions about the regulation of Moses by saying that Moses permitted you to divorce your wife because your hearts were hard. Moses permitted divorce, but he didn't command it. It was not a divine instruction, but only a divine concession to human weakness. But then he immediately refers again to the original purpose of God by saying, but from the beginning, it was not so. And thus, even the divine concession was in principle inconsistent with the divine institution. Let me make a third statement. The Pharisees regarded divorce lightly. Jesus took it so seriously that, with only one exception, he called all remarriage after divorce adultery. Now, it seems to be assumed that a divorce is going to lead to a remarriage of the divorced parties, which explains the statement that a man divorcing his wife without cause makes her an adulteress. That action could only result in that if she married again. You see, a separation without a divorce in legal terms is a modern arrangement that was unknown in the ancient world. Now, since God instituted marriage as an exclusive and a permanent union, a union which He makes and man must not break, Jesus draws the inevitable deduction that to divorce one's partner and marry another, or to marry a divorced person, is to enter a forbidden adulterous relationship. For the person who may have secured a divorce in the eyes of human law is still, in the eyes of God, married to his or her first partner. Only one exception is made to this principle. Jesus said, except for the cause of unchastity or immorality. Now, there are some people who reject the authenticity of this exception clause because it's absent from the parallel passages in Mark and Luke. But let me just say that its absence from Mark and Luke is due not to their ignorance of it, but to their acceptance of it as something taken for granted. After all, under the Mosaic law, adultery was punishable by death. Although the death penalty for the offense seems to have fallen in disuse by the time of Jesus. So nobody would have questioned marital unfaithfulness as a just ground for divorce. No one. Even the rivals, the rabbinic school, Shammai and Hillel, agreed about this. Their dispute was how much more widely we could take this phrase, some indecency. Now, the Greek word for unchastity or immorality is porneia, from which we get our English word pornography. It's a comprehensive word referring to some act of physical sexual immorality. When it's used of a married person, it refers to any illicit sexual intercourse, which may include adultery, homosexuality, bestiality, etc. Jesus is telling us here that the only situation in which divorce and remarriage are possible without breaking the seventh commandment is when it has already been broken by some serious sexual sin. Now, I won't talk about it today, but there is a second reason, I believe, expanded in the Scriptures given to us in 1 Corinthians 7, and that is willful desertion. Now, the Pharisees' attitude was, if we divorce our wives, the important thing is that we just divide the inheritance equally, you know, and they get half of what we sell the house for, and they get adequate alimony and support for the kids, and we'll do it all right, you know, we'll do it by the book. And Jesus says, no, I'm sorry, you cannot treat a woman like that. If you marry her, that's your wife, until death separates you. You stick it out with her. You stick to her like glue, even if she's not particularly easy to live with. Even if she's not exactly what you thought she was when you married her. Doesn't make any difference. You're married, and the only thing that would break that relationship is if she walks out and forms another relationship with another man. Now, he's not merely talking about adultery, I believe, here. Because she can be adulterous and still be taken back. But if she determines in her heart that she's going to live with another man and she commits adultery, then that breaks the marriage, Jesus says. But unless that happens, she's yours. For better or worse. And you stick to her like glue. And the Jews were saying, you know, as long as we don't hurt her too much, as long as we provide for her financially, then it's all right. And Jesus says, no, it's not all right. God hates divorce because it destroys people. Now, God does not hate divorced people. We don't know the difference between those two things, but God does. He simply hates divorce because it's so destructive. That's all. So don't divorce your wife. That's the point Jesus is making to these men. Love her. Love her. If you can't love her, learn to love her. Maybe you have to start loving her like your enemy. Start there. Then learn to love her as a friend. Then learn to love her as a wife. You can learn to love. I'll never forget when our family was in Ireland, we had tea with a group of very proper, intelligent, educated women one day, and somehow we got on the topic of divorce. I don't know how we got there. But when I gave my opinion, I could tell it was not very well received. Just by the looks on their faces. And one lady said to me, I'll never forget, she looked at me and she said, How can you say that? You can't learn to love. And I thought to myself, oh my goodness. If we can't learn to love, my friends, we're in trouble. Because learning to love is the supreme lesson of life. That's what we're here for, is to learn how to love. And the number one tool in our life to teach us how to love is the person that God has placed in our life for the rest of our lives. Because there's nothing to show you how selfish you are than another human being who lives with you every day. We can learn to love. And that's what Jesus has been teaching us in these verses. In doing so, you fulfill the intent of the law. These laws that seem to be so harsh are intended to teach us how to love people. Remember, that's the point of it all. That's the purpose of the law. And we should not take our guidelines from the world. We have to take them from the Word of God. And we must take our love to an extent that the world does not know. We have to love more than the world. You want to know the world's idea? Here's the world's idea. Taken from the book Divorce, How and When to Let Go. Let me just give you a paragraph of this incredible wisdom. Your marriage can wear out. People change their values and lifestyles. People want to experience new things. Change is a part of life. Change and personal growth are traits for you to be proud of, indicative of a vital, searching mind. You must accept the reality that in today's multifaceted world, it is especially easy for two persons to grow apart. Letting go of your marriage, if it is no longer fulfilling, there's the key word, can be the most successful thing you've ever done. Getting a divorce can be a positive, problem-solving, growth-oriented step. It can be a personal triumph. My friends, divorce is never a personal triumph. And those of you who've been through it know that truth. You know the pain. You know the hurt. And the offspring of our lives are the ones who know it the most and feel that pain the greatest. My friends, your personal self-fulfillment is not the goal of this world. Happiness is not what this world was created for. Character is what this world was created for. There's another world for happiness. There is. In fact, we don't even know what happiness is. Jesus said, you know, the way to find your life is to lose it. Proverbs tells us there's a way which seems right unto man, but the end thereof is destruction. Now, we can't love the way Jesus is talking about here by ourselves. We can't do it with self-effort. Because it's only the love of Christ that gives us the power to love one another on another level. It comes from depending on Him, from relying on Him. And when we do that, we have the love that we need to fulfill the intent of the law. One marriage counselor told me that in his estimate, the average person on the verge of a divorce has about 15 to 20% of the marriage, which is in trouble. Now think of that. Think through the implications of that statement. If that's true, that's telling us that generally speaking, 80 to 85% of the marriage is a good thing. So I throw away 80 to 85% because I'm in trouble with 15 to 20%. Let me just ask, how many people in this room have been married more than 20 years? Will you raise your hand? Look around. That's a lot of people. Now let me ask you, those of you who've been married that long, is there anyone here who has no problems in their relationship? Right here. Truthfulness is next Sunday's message. You know, I'll take the best marriage in this room, and if I can get one or both of those people to focus on the negative, I'll destroy that relationship in quicker than you could say, you know, whatever you want to say. It's quick. I want to challenge you, those of you who've been married 20, 30, 40, 50 years, to be a change agent in our church. Let me give a couple of suggestions. We have a great need to teach our young people in the area of love. Most people, most of the kids growing up in our society don't know the difference between love and lust. Between love and infatuation. They don't know the difference. And so they marry a body. And my friends, if you marry a body, every year that goes by, you're further out of business. You don't marry a body. You marry a person. Bodies deteriorate. Persons develop. And it takes time to develop the kind of relationship we want. Long time. And kids need to know that you're not going to get instant love the way you get instant sound on a television. It's just not there. It's developed over a long period of time. They also need to understand what marriage is all about. I am amazed at how easy it is at some churches to get married. All you need to do is grunt and you're in. And this is the most important of all human relationships. And we spend 10 more times preparing for the ceremony than we do the relationship. And that's why in our church, we require a pretty lengthy premarital counseling program before you get married. Because it's important. Far more important than the ceremony. Let me say, lastly, also, that we have a great need for models. We really need those. I don't even see Bruce, but I had lunch this past week with Bruce Beebe. We need more models like Bruce and Sally. And Bruce shared with me his great heart for meeting with younger couples. In fact, he and Sally have two groups together of younger couples just talking about marriage, caring for them. And he said to me over lunch, "Do you know any folks who've been married a long time who have similar burdens? I'd just like to meet with them and we could talk about how to care for younger couples." Those of you who've been married for 20 and 30 and 40 and 50 years need to come out of the woodwork. Because young people need to see that there's some people who by the grace of God have put this thing together. And we also need models of people who've been through divorce. We do. And who have seen the grace of God work in their life. We need both of those. There's a danger of becoming insensitive to people's needs who come out of a divorce experience. I know some pastors who know exactly what they believe about the divorce, but they haven't got a clue as to what to do with divorced people. No one ever showed them how to do that. They just know what they believe. You see, very rare is the person who comes into my office and says, "Do I have a legitimate reason to get divorced?" Very rare. Usually they just go out and get a divorce. And somewhere down the road, they think, I need help in this thing. And then they show up in my office. And divorce is devastating. And someone in that position needs grace, needs love, needs healing, needs to know a God who never gives up on people, who never trashes you, who never tells you it's over. He's not the God of second chances. He's the God of third and fourth and fifth and sixth and seventh and eighth and ninth and tenth and 11th and as many chances as you need. That's the God we have. Many of you here who have experienced divorce could stand up and give testimonies that drive this truth down our throats, that divorce is just painful, excruciating. And it's my desire that we would do everything within our power to seek to restore the relationships in our homes. Because that's where we need to begin. Because that's what our world needs. We are a very affluent people. But we are dying inside. We have beautiful homes and beautiful cars. But we have divorce and disintegration and pain and hurt. And it's my prayer that God would use our homes in those neighborhoods to be refuges of light and love and healing and grace. That's what our world needs. James, let's close and sing together.